Christmas is celebrated every year by millions of people around the world. But why? Why should we celebrate the birth of a baby almost 2,000 years ago? Well, to answer that question, we need to go back even further than that. We need to go back twice more that distance in time. We need to go back right to the beginning of the world. For the Bible tells us that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And out of this formless expanse, God formed this world that we are so familiar with. And yet, despite our familiarity with it, the world was quite different back then. No doubt it was different in its physical appearance from what it is now. And certainly, it was different in terms of what went on in it. For when God created the heavens and the earth, they were very good. When God formed this world, populated it with people as well as every other kind of creature, it was pronounced to be perfect. Well, that's a far cry from what we see around us today. Earthquakes, hurricanes, natural disasters of varying descriptions bring death and destruction in their wake. But that's hardly the mark of a perfect world, if you ask me. Not only that, but we have disease and decay of every imaginable description. This world is hardly a place of life and vitality. And furthermore, we see around us hatred, killing, cruelty, perpetrated by people from all different walks of life, from every kind of educational background. The privileged as well as the underprivileged are perpetrators of these crimes. The religious as well as the irreligious. No, we live in a world that is far from perfect. But it was first created perfect. There was no suffering. There was no death. God created a world in which man related perfectly to everyone else and to God. This was God's kingdom in creation. And everyone perfectly obeyed God. Well, there was only one man and one woman in that early earth. And they didn't follow God and obey God for very long. Mankind rebelled and brought the whole world under the curse of disharmony, destruction, and death, the marks of which I've just described and that we see so evident around us every day. Yes, creation was perfect, but the destruction was complete when man rebelled against his maker. But despite that rebellion, God was still totally committed to the world that he had made. He could have completely annihilated every living creature in a moment. He could have destroyed the cosmos. He could have wrapped it all up, thrown it away, and started again. But he didn't. He was committed to the world that he had made. He was committed to restoring the harmony that mankind had destroyed. He was committed to re-establishing the relationships which mankind had broken. He was committed to reconciling sinners to himself, a holy God. It was not his desire to see this world destroyed fully and finally and completely. It was his purpose, rather, to demonstrate his love and his grace in the face of rebellion. Not just to be able to show his love to those who love him. Not simply to be able to show his kindness and care to a world that lived in harmony with him. But it was the desire of God to show the greatness of his love in sparing a world that had rebelled against him. And so at the very beginnings of this history of destruction, disharmony, and death in this world, God provided a hint of his purpose. In the words that he spoke to the serpent who had tempted Eve into taking the forbidden fruit, which she also gave to her husband, Adam. He spoke words of hope. Words of prophetic significance. Words of promise. That there would come from the woman a deliverer. One who would crush the serpent who had brought this temptation to mankind and been the instigator of the rebellion of God's pinnacle in creation. The seed of the woman would come and would be responsible then for re-establishing these relationships, restoring the harmony and reconciling mankind to God. Children were born. And children to those children. And one generation after another appeared on the world. But things didn't get better. They got worse. Until God looked and he saw that the wickedness of man was so great in the world that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. Only one man appeared to trust in God. Only one man seemed to capture God's attention as one who stood out from the crowd of rebellious humanity. That man, of course, was Noah. And to Noah, God gave a commitment that he would save him and his family while destroying the rest of the world. And so we have the story of Noah's Ark. Not fable, not fantasy, not fiction, but a real event through which God demonstrated the reality of his judgment. If people on the earth ever thought that God's arm was too weak to bring destruction after the flood, there would be no question. God could completely and fully destroy this world. It was only his mercy that prevented him from doing so. It was only his purpose in bringing about a re-establishment of a new world order a restoration of Eden that prevented him from completely annihilating mankind. In Noah's flood, we have a graphic picture both of a commitment to save and a power to destroy. And also in Noah, we have a picture of God's commitment to re-establish the world. For the same command that had been given to Adam is given to Noah. And the same promise, too, is passed on to Noah. Generation after generation pass once again, and the centuries go by. And the world hasn't really changed very much despite the judgment. People continue to go on in their irreligious ways, certainly not acknowledging the one true God for the most part. And from among this host of heathen, God chose one man. His name was Abraham. He promised to make of Abraham a great nation through whom the whole world would be blessed. In the choosing of Abraham from all the nations of the world, we see that salvation, redemption, the establishment of God's purposes is his sovereign right alone. He chooses, he calls, he establishes, he saves. And this is again borne out in the story of the Exodus. A picture, a graphic picture of redemption. Salvation would take place by divine intervention. It would be the work of God. God, with powerful hand and outstretched arm, would save his people. They would be enslaved, powerless, weak, impotent, but God would draw them out of what seemed to be a hopeless situation, and he would establish them as a great and mighty nation. But this wasn't done for its own sake. This is just another unfolding of the revelation of God in this plan of redemption. You see, at each stage that we have seen a significant step of progress made and a significant picture presented, we have this increasing understanding of God's purpose in salvation. God chose Abraham. God brought the people of Israel out of Egypt, out of their slavery, as a picture of what he would do in the spiritual realm of their enslavement to sin. Further down the track of human history, a king is born in Israel. And again, God reveals his purposes. And he promises that a son would be born to this king who would reign forever on his throne. God's plan and God's purpose is being more narrowly focused. It began with Noah, from whom all the nations of the world have come. It became more narrowly focused in Abraham, from whom came a great nation with 12 distinct tribes. From among those tribes, one tribe was chosen, Judah. And then one family from that one tribe, the line of David. And all through the history of the children of Israel, we see evidence of God's purpose. His preservation of the lineage of David. At times it seemed as though the whole history of Israel was hopeless, as they repeatedly rebelled against God. And what do we see in that? In this period of declension, particularly during the reign of the kings, we see the reality of sin in the human heart. We see the desperate condition of mankind. It's not enough that God should choose people. It's not enough that they should be blessed abundantly, brought into a land of promise, a land with cities that they had not built and vineyards that they had not planted. All of this was not enough. What was needed was a transformation in the hearts of mankind. And the depravity of the kings and their rebellion against their supreme king, God, demonstrates the condition of the human heart. But in it all, God is still committed to his world, to the world that he had made, to the world that he has determined to restore in its harmony, in its relationships, to reconcile mankind to himself. And so he preserves the lineage of David, from whom the deliverer will come. And it's through all of that unfolding history then, with all the promises that are given, with all the prophecies that are made, and with the kind preservation of a sovereign God, that we come to a stable in Bethlehem. And we see there, born into poverty, a little baby, laid to rest in a manger, a feeding trough of animals. His parents are so poor that they can only offer for the purification of Mary following the birth of her son the very basic sacrifice that was prescribed in the law. And then they find themselves within a few days, months at the most, their life turned to that of refugees in a foreign land. And this baby that was laid to rest in that manger, born into such poverty, living in a status as refugee in a foreign land, is none other than the seed of the woman who was promised in the curse pronounced upon the Satan. This is none other than the one who will restore the harmony to the world. This is none other than the one who will re-establish relationships and reconcile mankind to his Maker. This poverty-stricken child. But there's more. For the New Testament doesn't suddenly stop revealing and only pronounce the fulfillment of prophecy. Here we have the greatest revelation of all, that the promised one, the Messiah, the deliverer, is none other than God himself in the flesh. This is the Word who brought this world into being and pronounced it very good. This is the word that has sustained this world through all the ages of history. This is the powerful Word who spoke such blessed promises to Noah and Abraham and Moses and David. This is the Word that has raised nations up and cast nations down to fulfill his purposes in bringing salvation to his people. And this Word is incarnated as a mere baby in a poverty-stricken place. And he is going to redeem. He is going to deliver. He is going to establish a new world order. Yes, God, who enthroned in glory, worshipped by cherubim and seraphim, with thousands and thousands of angels to do his bidding, humbles himself and takes on the form of man, born to a virgin in poverty, growing up, living a perfect life in order to redeem his people. And as that baby lay there in those poverty-stricken circumstances, word is brought to Herod the king. Where is the king? Where is he who was born king of the Jews? Herod called the religious leaders and asked what this could be about and where he might be found. Herod proclaims that he will worship this one who has been born king of the Jews. But in reality, we find that it is his purpose to destroy him. Such is the state of the heart of man. Oh, it's not just Herod. Herod, a man like Herod, might be willing to proclaim that every male child within a particular region, aged 2 years old or under, must be put to death just for the sake of protecting his throne. Yes, a man as vile as Herod might make such a pronouncement, and we think ourselves clear of anything like that degree of hatred. But there are millions upon millions of people in this world who hate God. They'll spend thousands of dollars to put an advert on the side of a bus. God probably doesn't exist. So go and enjoy life. There are millions and millions of people in this world who wish God was dead and seek to convince themselves that there is no God. There are others who don't go quite that far. But even knowing that there is a God, and knowing much about God, are nevertheless completely indifferent to God. Those religious leaders whom Herod had called into his chamber to determine from them where a king of the Jews might be born, if not in his palace, these religious leaders, so well versed in the Old Testament scriptures, are immediately able to say, well, it will be in Bethlehem. And they're able to quote chapter and verse. You, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. But what do? Well, they don't go searching for him. They don't accompany the wise men to ascertain where this child is. They have no desire themselves to bow down and worship him. They seem completely indifferent to the prospect that the deliverer may have come. that the King of the Jews, of whom these Magi from the east spoke, may actually have arrived. The whole of Jerusalem, we are told, are troubled about the news, but these men are not troubled enough to go searching for the Messiah. Well, you may not have the hatred of Herod in your heart, but do you have the indifference of the spiritual leaders? But there were others who responded quite differently. Here are Magi from the east who came to Jerusalem after a long journey. They came with the purpose of worshipping the one who was born King of the Jews. And when eventually they found him, it was with exceeding joy. And with rich treasures, they bow down before him and worship him. They were wealthy foreigners. But on the hillsides outside Bethlehem on the night that this child was born, angels announced his birth to poor shepherds tending their sheep. And they too, presumably leaving their flocks on the hillside, went and searched out and found this baby and observed him wrapped and lying in a manger. And they too returned to their flocks, glorifying God and marveling at what they had seen. At Christmas, we celebrate the incarnation of the Son of God. Not God coming gloriously into this world to a rapturous reception. Not God warmly hailed as king and ruler and sovereign, before whom the peoples of the world bow in homage. No, we celebrate the incarnation of the Son of God in humility, coming to a world that is desperate and dying, coming to a world that is hostile to him, coming even to a people specially chosen out of all the peoples of the world to be the vehicle for his coming. And even they do not recognize him. It is not surprising then that the celebration of the birth of Jesus of Nazareth has degenerated into just a social occasion. The question is, are we in awe of a God who would stoop to us in this way? Are we in awe of a God who would so love this world that he would come in the person of his Son, be born in humble circumstances in order to save this world? Are we in awe of a God who patiently, over 4,000 years of history, gradually revealed his purposes to mankind and demonstrated with various pictures the reality of his commitment to this world and the reality of his judgment upon those who would reject him? Do we stand in awe of a God who would become one of us in order to save us when we have done nothing to him or for him except shake our fists in rebellion? Are we this day standing in awe of the God who came as Jesus of Nazareth? For unless we stand in awe of this God, we are in danger of coming under the judgment of this God. God came to seek and to save the lost. Are you thankful for his coming?